Welcome to Nature's Edge, where we explore a wide range of topics that can immerse you, the listener, in the wonder, surprise, and importance that nature has to offer. We have a most interesting guest today joining us, Dr. Patricia Gray. She is the director of UNC Greensboro Biomusic Program. She is also the artistic director and pianist of the National Musical Arts and has appeared in performances with leading orchestras and chamber musicians around the country. Dr. Gray, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you in the audience.
I'm going to jump right in here, Dr. Gray, and say, how did you go from a concert pianist to sound research or biomusic research?
Well, actually, it's a very interesting profession to be a musician, because you obviously have a real passion inside of you that you can put through into a nonverbal kind of communication system. And it's something that I think works very, very well with children early on, because it doesn't require you to be literate even. You know, this is an innate thing that is born inside of all of us, is this musical capacity. And so I was raised in a very musical family, and it was sort of the family business. And so I went into the family business, just full throttle, and fortunately got on this path where I was able to become a professional at doing the musical expression through being a pianist. And at some point in my life, I was able to move into an interesting realm at the National Academy of Sciences, which is sort of the top level of membership-only scientists, and it's based in Washington, D.C. And the Academy, because of its role literally in the world, is sort of the ultimate place for scientists to meet, has this this sort of imprimatur of being an interesting place to explore the world generally. And so they have within the confines of the Academy of Sciences, the National Academy of Sciences, a resident arts program. And the reason that exists is because there is a perspective from their mission that they are looking for big answers to the world and ask big questions, try to wrestle in with big questions and big answers. And so I was put into a position where I was a musician, a professional musician, within this environment of science. And in the mid-80s, within the science world, the whole concept of biodiversity started to grow, and that is essentially that all life on the planet is interconnected. And the Academy decided to host an international conference that brought in all of these amazing scientists from all over the world to really wrestle this new concept into various ways of interpreting what that would mean for the sciences. And I was asked to perform for that particular conference. And so I was thrust into this fascinating conversation about the interconnectedness of all life and, you know, the musical part of that I thought was an important thing to bring forward because it doesn't require any kind of language about it. It's its own force of communication. And so at that conference, there was a group of scientists who spend their focus is on animal communication and how does animal communication work. And they had been living in a world where animal communication was typically laid over human language. And trying to interpret animal communication, other species communication, using human language as the model created a lot of complications and a lot of blind alleys. And so we started talking about the musicality of communication and whether animal communication actually could be better understood if you look at music as maybe the underlying primal system that is part of this big universe of connection of all life. And I was, you know, as a professional musician, I have had many, many experiences where performing with other musicians, you just get overwhelmed with the power of music. I mean, to the point where I've had such transforming experiences where when we got to the end of the performance, I wasn't sure I had the strength to actually stand up and get off the piano bench. And I know from audiences' reaction that music is an overwhelming power. And, you know, where does that come from? So I had inside of me a why. Why is this this system of putting time and sound together in various ways? Why is that so important?
Dr. Gray, let me,
our species.
Excuse me. Let me ask you, is this where the biomusic research came from?
Yes.
Could you define biomusic for us a little bit?
Sure. Well, it starts off being a word that is built out of biology and music.
Yeah.
And so when it's spelled, there's a capital B and a capital M, so biomusic, the biology of music. It turns out that it's actually the science of music as well. And that underlying world of musical communication requires that in order for you to get into that, you need to drop your presumptions that you know what music is. You know, one of the interesting things that I found out when I was a student was that there is no agreed-upon definition of what music is. You cannot find a definition that everybody will agree on. So music, human music, is a complicated matter. So, but we're used to thinking of human music as, you know, a singular thing. If you, as a musician, we take it apart and we deal with time, like rhythm and beat, and we also deal with the sound, you know, how the sound is put together, what are the various pitches or the notes, and, you know, how is that phrased off into sections. And if you start looking at music by actually deconstructing it, then you get down to the process of music making. And that's where biomusic lives, in the process part of the world. So, you know, how is it that when you go to a concert that you can just tap your toe or your foot, or you can dance in time to the beat? Nobody has to teach you how to do that. Right. It is part of the biology that has been delivered to you through evolution, in that you can immediately entrain to a beat.
And animals make music, correct?
Well, here's where we have to be careful, because we humans have co-opted that word music and made it our own.
Understand.
So what I would prefer that we talk about is the process. So we're going to call it music making.
Ah.
And animals do things within their animal communication systems that are part of music making. So they can entrain to a beat. They can create patterns of pitches that they remember and can sing back to each other. And that, you know, within their group, they understand what that pitch pattern means. So, you know, that's very much like being able to remember happy birthday. We can all immediately start to sing happy birthday together.
Sure.
Well, that kind of memory of musical patterns is something that is, you can find it in many, many parts of the animal world. I mean, obviously people immediately think about birds, but rarely do people immediately think about, for instance, humpback whales. Humpbacks create, as a group, all the whales in a particular ocean actually compose together a seasonal song, which they will sing in a cooperative way for 6 months. And then when they go to the hunting grounds and feed for 6 months, they go silent. But then when they return to the areas of the ocean where they're going to mate and so on, they remember last year's seasonal song, and they start and sing that first.
So that's it's a form of animal communication?
Yes. So that musical memory is something that whales have, elephants have, dolphins have. It's how they recognize each other. They know how to collaborate in order to create their own signature patterns, for instance. And that memory, that musical memory, is something that we share with other species, just as we share the ability to entrain a beat. That is also something that other species know how to do. We can recognize certain patterns of pitches and time that, regardless of whether it's played fast or slow, and other species can do the same thing. So it's what we're finding is that there is contained within human music, there are all of these elements of manipulating sound and time into patterns that are recognizable and that can be memorized and then remembered over long stretches of time as a way of bonding, of creating essentially a culture. And so, you know, from my perspective, I get very excited as a musician about this.
Sure.
Because it lifts music beyond the realm of just entertainment. You know, it's now sort of it is deeply embedded in all of life.
It is.
So the music making part of the human experience connects us to all of this other life around us.
Let me ask you, saying that, has the technology that we humans that we have developed, has that had a disruptive part on animal communications or how animals communicate?
Well, you know, technology cuts in multiple ways.
Yes.
So there are good ways that technology actually helps us. I mean, so that we can, for instance, we can actually monitor marine environments now with hydrophones so that we can have a pretty good understanding of which species, for instance, are at a reef, like the Mesoamerican reef off of Cancun area. And we can monitor by sounds and sort of collaborative approaches to sound mapping of the reef. You can really think about sound as or I should say recording of sound as a conservation approach. Now, on the other hand, what are we finding when we actually sound map the reef is that there are intrusive sounds that we make as humans. So, for instance, boats or drilling or those kinds of things can and often do disrupt life patterns that are used to having control over their environment. And of course, on the terrestrial side, there are many examples of where you can, again, use technology to record who's there in a particular place when you don't have time to wait for a species to show up, or you can't really see everything. So sound is used as a way of understanding the environment and the conservation issues. On the other hand, there are plenty of examples, for instance, the California wren, who's had its sound environment invaded by car traffic sounds up and down freeways. And so because the sound of all of that traffic actually blankets the range that they are used to being able to communicate with each other in, they have, over a period of time, transposed up their singing into a higher range so that they can actually hear each other. So, yeah, they're... You know, we have a lot of issues having to do with sharing the sound environment in a responsible way, and so that there, in many respects, we can use technology to help us understand what the parameters are for various species and what they need in order to be able to survive and communicate with each other.
Dr. Gray, we've
got... On the other hand, we can get in the way as well.
Oh, yeah. Dr. Gray, we've got about 5 minutes left, and I did want you to talk a little bit about why it is essential to teach children music.
Oh, okay, sure. What we've come to understand is that when the human brain develops, and now we're going into child development and the neuroscience of the brain, that children who are learning music as well as learning verbal language, there are multiple parts of their brain that are growing in tandem with each other. And so we now see very clearly that children who are engaged in doing music in a serious way actually are growing larger brains. They are using more of their brains, and there's more of a neural hookup. And particularly if kids are using some sort of large muscle system, if you're, you know, learning how to play the violin or the guitar or the piano, where, you know, you're actually using a lot of your physical structure in combination with all of the musical system within your brain, you actually have a greater use, a greater capacity is grown in a child's brain. And I don't have to tell the audience that that just gives children a much greater advantage to be able to make all kinds of connections as they grow into full adulthood.
And I know you're also very interested in ways that we can use sounds of nature as a mechanism to work with children on music, correct?
Absolutely. I've spent a great deal of time working with children to help them understand how their musical selves are connected in this evolutionary process with other species. And this just opens up a whole new realm of excitement for them to learn, because they can use their innate musical selves to connect with species that most of them would never really have much contact with. For instance, bonobo apes. They can actually understand that bonobo apes can entrain to a beat like they can, or like their little brother and sister can. And these kinds of connections of being able to understand how patterns of sound actually give you a lot of information about the world helps you then translate all the sounds that are around you. So if you're walking through, you know, on your way to school, you start to pay attention to the birds and understand that there are different patterns of different species around you. It builds a relationship with your sound environment that wouldn't be there if you were just sort of left to be ignorant of it.
Yeah, I think that's amazing work that you're doing, Dr. Gray, and particularly as it relates to children and music and of course, my passion, the outside world. I wanted to, Dr. Gray, I want to thank you so much for taking time out today and visiting with us on Nature's Edge. And do you have is there a website or some place that someone could go to learn more about biomusic and your programs?
You can certainly go to the University of North Carolina Greensboro website. And then just plug in biomusic, and a lot of information will come up very quickly.
Dr. Gray, again, thank you so very much for joining us on Nature's Edge, and we will have to have a additional conversation about this subject. It is certainly very interesting to me. Thank you.
Well, I'm honored to be able to talk with you, Dale, and your audience, and I look forward to having more conversations, hopefully, in the future.
Absolutely. Guys, thanks for listening to Nature's Edge, and we will see you out in the wild.